All right, so this is the last time I can remind you in person that the withdrawal deadline's tomorrow. Many have already exercised that option, which is why it's easier to find a seat in here than it was on the first day. So I just want to say what I already told you last time. Make sure, now that the grades are as current as they can be, it's really important to take a final look at compare your total current score to two calculated scores. You have a score called final score assuming 25% improvement, and you have a score called minimum score required for whatever grade you're trying to get. All right, say it's a C. If that minimum score required for a C already says not possible, I hope you realize what that means. It means that even if you get 100% on everything remaining, you're still not going to get that C. But if it gives you a number, and that number is substantially higher than your total current score, that's where you need to consider withdrawing. And that's why I also have the 25% improvement score. A 25% improvement is a hell of a big improvement. Almost no one ever makes a 25% improvement for the rest of the term. So if that score is lower than the score that you need to get the C, then that tells you it's nearly impossible. So keep that in mind. All right? But make the decision today, because tomorrow's the deadline. Another thing I wanted to say, though, regarding scores is that a couple of you might have noticed that your total score changed even though no additional assignment was added. Most of you didn't notice this because it didn't affect most people. But anyway, I intend in the next term to have to tweak the policy of attendance a little bit. In which case I'm going to not count attendance if you can demonstrate that you do very well without it anyway. And so I figured I would actually implement the policy early in case it helps anyone here. So now, starting as a few days ago, your scores, your total score plus all those calculated scores, minimum required, blah, 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 those are all now simultaneously calculated two different ways, with and without attendance. Now, attendance points are here because I think it's important to attend, but also as a way to give you some comparatively easy points. And so that's why the vast majority of the people have a better score with attendance counted than without attendance counted. But I'm calculating it both ways. The thing is, if you calculate it without attendance, that makes all the other kinds of assignments more valuable. And therefore, lower scores on those are going to hurt you more. But I do it both ways, and whichever is higher, that's the score I give you. So you might have, like five or six of you might have seen a slight rise in your total score. That's because it's being calculated without attendance in that case. This does not mean, though, that you should not keep signing in on time, because it can go back and forth. It could be that after some scores are added, your score with attendance would actually be higher than without. And therefore, if you ruin that attendance batch of scores by not signing in on time, you'll be doing yourself a disservice. All right? Let's go on to the fifth unit then. Fifth unit is a little unusual in that all we have is one chapter. And therefore only three meetings, so it happens pretty soon. So all we're covering is one chapter, but that one chapter is fairly long in terms of number of slides. I think it's like 33 slides long. And this is kind of the other side of what we just covered in the previous chapter. The previous chapter, remember, was partly central nervous system, partly peripheral nervous system, because it was spinal cord and spinal nerves. Well, this is brain, the rest of the central nervous system, and cranial nerves, the other nerves besides the spinal nerves. So once again, it's part central nervous system and part peripheral nervous system, but it makes sense to study them that way because there's a direct connection between cranial nerves and the brain, anatomically and physiologically. So we'll start with just looking at the brain as a whole in this opening slide, the uncut brain. The brain is the most important organ in the body, but it's also the one that we know the least about. A lot of organs, we know pretty well how they operate. The brain is, I don't need to tell you that the brain is pretty complex in terms of all the circuitry involved. Figuring it out is a huge task and has been for a long time, and it will continue to be for a while. We've learned a lot about how the brain works, so you know, you could dedicate two terms to a two-semester class to just what we do know about the brain, but despite what we do know about it, there's a hell of a lot we still do not know about it. In any case, we're only going to scratch the surface in this course. We're going to take a look at mostly the anatomy, but some of the physiology as well. The brain is broken down into parts in various different ways that can be confusing. There are major landmarks in the brain, though, that we see on this opening slide. And really, the part of the brain that is what most people think of when we use the word brain is the cerebrum, a word that actually means brain. But the cerebrum is not the entire brain. It's just the part that we think looks brainy. And that's all we see from this top view on the upper left. That's all cerebrum. Cerebrum is the largest part of the brain. And it is dominated by, superficially at least, it is dominated by a bunch of hills and valleys. Now, the hills are called gyri. That's a plural. The singular is gyrus. And then the little valleys between these hills, in other words, the cracks in the surface of the brain, are sulci. That's the plural of sulcus. So one of them is a sulcus. So there's a sulcus between two gyri. That's the pattern. That's what gives it that brainy appearance. Notice, though, that the cerebrum also is broken into two major hemispheres. There's a right half and a left half. So the cerebral hemispheres are mirror images of each other. There's bilateral symmetry with respect to the cerebrum. But that doesn't mean that the right and left halves do exactly the same jobs. They do many of the same jobs in duplicate for different halves of the body. But there are some things that the right half does, or the right hemisphere does, that the left doesn't, and vice versa. Anyway, that division mark between the two hemispheres, which is itself a groove, but much deeper than a sulcus, is the longitudinal fissure that you see. A very deep groove that actually separates the two cerebral hemispheres and runs medially from front to back. Okay, so fissure is just a word that means crack, but it's much deeper than a sulcus, which is also a crack in a sense. Now notice on the upper right, in the shaded blue, There are the terms rostral and caudal. These are terms that are typically applied to the brain and spinal cord, or the central nervous system as a whole. Rostral, they're directional terms. Rostral means toward the nose. Rostrum means nose. Whereas caudal means toward the caudus, or tail. Well, even though we developmentally start out with a tail, we don't have a tail in adulthood, but many animals do, and that's what these words are really, that's how they got started, toward the nose end, toward the tail end, which makes sense in a animal like a dog or a sheep that walks around on four legs. We're bipedal, right? And so the shape of our central nervous system is a little bit different compared to these things that walk on four legs. If you think of a sheep, the brain is there in the head, of course, and then the rest of the central nervous system is the spinal cord, which runs horizontally. And therefore it makes sense to say, to use directional terms that point toward the nose end or the tail end, because it's all lined up that way. In humans, though, it's lined up vertically because we're bipedal organisms. And so really, the cerebrum is oriented a little differently compared to the brainstem, which is the stalk that the cerebrum sits on and that leads to the spinal cord. In a quadrupedal animal, the brainstem and spinal cord project backward, whereas they project downward in a human. But it's the same setup as far as sets of structure are concerned. Anyway, caudal makes sense when you're in the cerebrum because there's a front and a back that makes sense. Rostral is anterior, caudal is posterior. But we also, on the vertical part of our central nervous system, continue to use rostral and caudal. So the upper part of the brainstem would be rostral compared to the lower part, and caudal would mean going farther down the spinal cord, just like it would be going farther back on an animal where their spinal cord is horizontally shaped, placed, I mean. Okay, so that's the meaning of those terms. Now, another very large part of the brain is the cerebellum, which also has hemispheres on it. In fact, the word cerebellum means, notice the similarity with cerebrum, cerebellum means little brain. Now, of course, there's one brain, and the cerebrum and cerebellum are just two parts of it, along with other stuff, but that's what cerebellum means. And that makes sense because it looks like a little version of the cerebrum because it also has little hills and valleys in it, even though they're called different things. We'll talk about the cerebellum in a different slide in more detail. Anyway, one important thing about the cerebellum is that even though it's much smaller than the cerebrum, as you can see here, actually, more than half of all the neurons in the brain are in the cerebellum. So it is a compact structure in terms of the number of neurons that are contained therein. The cerebrum is where all the high, very highest level processing of information occurs. And so the cerebrum gives you your personality. It's where you decide to do things. It's where almost all sensation occurs, right? So you get touched on the thigh. It feels like that's happening at that thigh, that sensation. But that's happening in your cerebrum after that information reaches the cerebrum. All your deep thought occurs in the cerebrum. So that's obviously, in a sense, the cerebrum, more than any other single part of the body, is you. And more generally, the brain, which includes the cerebrum, is you, right? If you lose a kidney, you wouldn't think of what's left as not being you, right? It's just you without a kidney. you without a brain would not be you anymore, because you is what's really happening in your brain. And that's why I say it's the most important organ. Okay, now the brainstem itself is kind of a tricky term, because it's what is included in the brainstem differs from one authority to another. But the brainstem definitely does include the midbrain, the pons, and the medulla oblongata. So everyone agrees on that. Some people will also lump the diencephalon, which we'll look at in a minute, with that brainstem as well. And this book does that. But that brainstem and diencephalon are kind of the stalk of a mushroom in terms of how the shape is. And then the cerebrum is the big fruiting body, the part that looks like the mushroom top, sitting on that brainstem, and the cerebellum a little bit behind it, as we see there. Now, the spinal cord is labeled there at the bottom of the brainstem. It's continuous with the medulla oblongata, which is the bottom part of the brainstem, and we'll look at these words in a different slide as well. But where does it stop being brain and start being spinal cord? Well, at the end of the medulla oblongata, which is the bottom part of the brainstem. But where does that occur on the body? What's the landmark where that occurs? I think I already told you. What is it? It's a bony feature that actually officially is the end of the brain and the beginning of the spinal cord. The foramen magnum, which is the big hole, literally, that's what that means, the big hole in the base of the skull, in the occipital bone, that the medulla oblongata starts to poke through, but as soon as it gets to the foramen magnum, then it's no longer the medulla oblongata, no longer the brain, it becomes the spinal cord, and that travels down, of course, the vertebral canal, made up by all the vertebral foramina of the spinal column. Now, the cerebrum is also, aside from being broken into two hemispheres, left and right cerebral hemispheres, each hemisphere is also broken down into regions called lobes. As you see here, the frontal lobe is listed, the parietal lobe, the occipital lobe. And from the side view, you can also see a temporal lobe. Well, notice that these correspond, at least roughly, to bones of the skull, right? The frontal bone, well, deep to that is where you encounter the brain, and that part, that lobe, is the frontal lobe. There's an occipital lobe, temporal lobe, and so on. On the photograph on the bottom, notice that the front of the brain, the rostral side, which is the left side to you as you're viewing it, this is just brain tissue that we're looking at, because the meninges have been removed here. That's why it looks a little different from the back. There aren't any blood vessels. There isn't any of the shiny stuff. That's because the meninges have been removed. They're, of course, there in a healthy brain, but they've just been removed to show you the difference. On the back, you still have the meninges intact. And what are the three meninges? Those are parts of their names. Dura mater, pia mater, arachnoid mater. Right. What is the most superficial of those? The dura mater. What's the least superficial? The pia mater. So the pia mater, just like for the spinal cord, the pia mater is right on the surface of the brain. Very thin, delicate membrane. The arachnoid mater is between the other two meninges, and includes a bunch of blood vessels passing through it as well, which is why you don't see the blood vessels on the rostral part of this photograph. And then the dura mater, actually around the brain, unlike the spinal cord, occurs in two layers that we'll look at in a different slide. But you do have all three meninges around the brain, just like around the spinal cord, and they're continuous with each other as you transition from brain to spinal cord. In the second slide, we're looking at the brain again, but now we're looking at it cut in half through that longitudinal fissure that separates the two cerebral hemispheres. So we're looking at it with the left half removed. We're looking at the right hemisphere with the left half having been removed. And now you get a good view of the midbrain, the pons, and the medulla oblongata, which make up the brain stem, kind of like the stalk of a mushroom, like I said. At the one thing that you didn't see in the previous view is this conspicuous kind of sideways C-shaped white piece that is called the corpus callosum. You see it in the photograph as well. It's hard to miss when you do a dissection of a brain. It's not only because of its shape and its size, but because it's white. So why do you suppose it is white? It's myelinated axons, correct. The corpus callosum, which means calloused body, or kind of tough body, like a callus. We've cut through it here. Now notice you didn't really cut into the cerebrum to make this cut, because the longitudinal fissure is already there. But when you get to the depths of the longitudinal fissure, that's the top of the corpus callosum that actually extends into both halves. And you're cutting through that corpus callosum to get this view. I say that because the corpus callosum joins the two hemispheres. And so what's going on at the corpus callosum if it joins the two hemispheres? What do you call such a arrangement of neurons? Decussation, correct. Well, decussation is the act of crossing over, like we discussed. But a structure at which there is a lot of decussation occurring is called a commissure. C-O-M-M-I-S-S-U-R-E. And that's what the corpus callosum is. It's the major commissure in the cerebrum, connecting right and left halves. Now notice it forms kind of a roof over this area right here, labeled as the thalamus. Now the thalamus comes, the name for that means inner chamber or inner room, like a room that you'd have to walk through other rooms in a house to get to. It's called that because it's very deep in the brain. And then there are other structures around the thalamus named for their position with respect to the thalamus, like the epithalamus and the hypothalamus and the subthalamus. All of those together, epithalamus, subthalamus, hypothalamus, and the thalamus itself, make up the diencephalon that we're going to talk more about. And this is what I said. Some books will say the diencephalon is not actually part of the brainstem. It's its own division. Others will say, we'll lump it in with the brainstem, like this book does. So, if you don't include it in the brainstem, what the diencephalon is a structure, a set of structures, that actually lies right on top of the brainstem. If you include it in the brainstem like this book does, it's the very top part, or the very rostral part of the brainstem. And that's why I say it's confusing, because there should be a standard as to whether it's included or not. There just isn't. Now, the brainstem certainly does include midbrain, pons, and medulla oblongata. Like I said, the midbrain is the most rostral of those three, as you see here. The pons is, in terms of identifying it with the naked eye, is identified by the fact that it's a bulge in this brainstem, an anterior bulge. So just this region is the pons. And when that bulge ends and you continue caudally, then you have the rest of the brainstem, which is the medulla oblongata. And right about here is where that foramen magnum in the occipital bone would be. So that's the end of the brain, because it's the end of the medulla oblongata, and the beginning of the spinal cord. Now, we're going to talk more about ventricles as well. Ventricles are spaces, and there are four ventricles in the brain, but they're connected by other spaces as well that aren't called ventricles. And in these ventricles, what do we find? What fills the spaces? Cerebrospinal fluid, right. So called because it's not only in the brain, but it's in the spinal cord as well. Well, that cerebrospinal fluid, do you remember what kind of cells produce it? Ependymal cells, correct. Which are what kind of cells themselves? They are neuroglia, correct. They're not neurons, they're neuroglia. There's six major kinds of neuroglia that we talked about. Ependymal cells produce cerebrospinal fluid, but not all of the ependymal cells. The ependymal cells form a lining, just like an epithelium would, around all of these spaces. So the cerebrospinal fluid is in direct contact with all of these ependymal cells, but there are only certain subpopulations of ependymal cells that are specialized for actually producing the cerebrospinal fluid. The run-of-the-mill ependymal cells are just there lining these spaces. Okay? The little populations of specialized ependymal cells that actually produce the cerebrospinal fluid, collectively, those little populations are called choroid plexuses. And we see a choroid plexus labeled here, right there. Now, that word choroid means like the chorion. The chorion is one of the membranes that we chordates develop from. So someone called it the choroid plexus simply because it looks like the chorion of a developing embryo. Anyway, the choroid plexus has nothing to do with a developing embryo. It's these specialized ependymal cells that not only actually produce the cerebrospinal fluid, but also help to circulate it because they are ciliated cells. They have little cilia whipping all the time and help to set up currents. All right, so we see one of those right there, and the space that choroid plexus that's labeled there is in is one of the ventricles. But this is a mid-sagittal section that we've cut here, right? And notice that space would be just on the right side of the brain. Well, there's a corresponding left space right next to it. So there are two of the four ventricles that we're going to talk about are side by side. And we're looking at one of those on this slide. The ventricles themselves, two of them are called third and fourth, but there's no ventricles called first and second. And this is because of what I just told you. There's symmetry for the first two. So who's to say which one is first and which one is second? They're side by side. Therefore, they are called the lateral ventricles, meaning to the side. And there's a right lateral ventricle and a left lateral ventricle. So there isn't one that we call first or second, but there then is one that we call the third ventricle, which is, instead of being to one side or the other, is right on the midline. The third ventricle is labeled... Is it labeled in this one even at all? No, it isn't. But the third ventricle is a, like all ventricles, is a space that is around the thalamus. Now, the thalamus, which we'll get a better look at later as well, is a two-lobed structure. So there's two side-by-side lobes that make up the thalamus, kind of like a yo-yo. Notice that a yo-yo has two-sided lobes, two lobes, one on either side, but then a thin stalk connects the two lobes. The thalamus has that same arrangement. Well, just like in a yo-yo, there is a space between those sides, and that's where you wind the string. Well, that space between the two thalamic lobes in the brain is the third ventricle. So the space where you would put the string of the yo-yo is the third ventricle. That third ventricle then leads to a passageway, which itself is a space, but that space is called the cerebral aqueduct because it's really narrow. It's not a big open space like the ones that are really called ventricles are. And that cerebral aqueduct then leads directly to the fourth ventricle, which is a much wider space. And notice that the fourth ventricle is found right between the cerebellum to the posterior side and the brainstem, is specifically the pons to the anterior side. All right, so it's that little diamond-shaped one. And fourth ventricle is right here in this photographic view. Okay, I didn't mention I'll mention that later. Let's talk about brain development for just a little bit. Slide 3. Notice the days, 19, 20, 22, 26 days. So we're talking about 3 weeks into development of an embryo. This is when the nervous system starts to develop. And what you have early on is, even before the 19 days, what you have very early on in a developing embryo in most animals, including us, which are called triploblasts, is three germ layers, as they're called, three layers of tissue that develop into other stuff. So you have ectoderm, endoderm, and mesoderm, and they become different things. The ectoderm mostly becomes things toward the outside of the body. The endoderm mostly becomes the viscera, and so on. Well, no, that's why I mention those, because notice that the orange stuff here is labeled as ectoderm. So the nervous system develops from the ectoderm. Now, that's not the only thing that the ectoderm becomes, but the skin, for instance, comes from ectoderm as well. But that's where the brain and spinal cord develop from early on. And so you have just a little band of ectoderm defined by those yellow boundaries called the neural plate that's starting to develop. And notice that the neural plate is starting to invaginate or cave in just a little bit. That's at 19 days. Well, the next day, that invagination is much more pronounced. So it's starting to roll up into a tube, basically, is what's happening here. And in fact, once that rolling up gets complete, we call it the neural tube. You can see it at 26 days. It's a complete tube now that is hollow. Well, the hollowness of that is going to correspond to the ventricles I just talked about and in the brain. And what is the hollow part of the spinal cord called? There's cerebrospinal fluid in the spinal cord as well, which is why it's not just called cerebral fluid. It's cerebrospinal fluid. The central canal of the spinal cord is the hollow part where you find cerebrospinal fluid in the spinal cord. And so that's corresponds to the lumen, or the hollow part of this neural tube. The neural crest in yellow, these neural crests that move around and then start developing, will form most of the peripheral nervous system. Those turn into the nerves. whereas the neural tube will undergo much more differentiation than beyond this, what we see at 26 days, of course, and become the various parts of the brain that we've been talking about, some of which we've been talking about already. These somites in red, just since they're listed, I'll just tell you that they become all kinds of different body parts, including the various vertebrae, at least in the region of the spinal cord, not the brain, of course, but the spinal cord region of this neural tube. The somites will form the vertebrae themselves, which, of course, form in such a way so that they enclose the spinal cord that comes from that neural tube. All right, so that's pretty early development, and there wasn't really much differentiation at all. It was simply a neural tube. You couldn't really tell where the brain was or where the spinal cord. There isn't really a brain or spinal cord yet. But by the time you get to 4 weeks, as in slide 4, part A, you can see that this neural tube at the rostral end, which is the head end, develops 3 bulges in it. And these bulges are called vesicles. Remember, a vesicle is a word that means little bag. So we use those words to describe the little bags of membrane that house neurotransmitter molecules. Same word here. But be careful with the words vesicle and ventricle. There are brain ventricles. Those are the spaces that I've talked about already a little bit, and we're going to look at more. The ventricles house the cerebral spinal fluid. The vesicles are not adult structures. These are embryonic enlargements of the neural tube that correspond to adult brain structures, but they're only called vesicles early on, before you're born. And so this happens in 2 major stages. In the first stage, there are 3 vesicles, and therefore we call them primary brain vesicles that develop. And they're color-coded here, blue, red, and green. The purple is not part of the brain, of course. It's the spinal cord, but it develops from the neural tube as well. Anyway, notice the names here. These are the names of the 3 primary brain vesicles. They are prosencephalon, mesencephalon, and rhombencephalon. Now, they don't look like much yet, but these things are going to, of course, continue to differentiate. And so a little more time passes, another week or so passes, and the 3 primary brain divisions undergo subdivision. Well, at least 2 of those 3 do. And therefore, there are 5 secondary brain vesicles. This is just later on in development. You have 5 because the prosencephalon, which is the most rostral of the primary vesicles, subdivides into 2. And so does the most caudal, the rhombencephalon. The mesencephalon continues to develop, but it doesn't subdivide. So that's why you have a total of 5. So notice that the prosencephalon, which we have originally, breaks into the telencephalon and the diencephalon. Orange and blue regions there. And I've already mentioned diencephalon already. All of these words have encephalon in them, I'm sure you've noticed. What does encephalon mean? Anyone know? What is encephalitis? Itis means what? Inflammation. Encephalon means brain. Okay? Cephalon means head, but encephalon means brain. That's why you have words like cephalic, which means of the head, not necessarily the brain. All right? So, telencephalon and diencephalon are the 2 parts that come from the prosencephalon originally. The mesencephalon, like I said, remains the mesencephalon, which literally means midbrain. Just like mesoderm means the middle layer, middle skin layer. Mesencephalon means middle brain. And so in the adult, We're going to call that the midbrain. The rhombencephalon subdivides into the metencephalon and the myelencephalon. For some reason, they use two different versions of green here, or yellowish green, which kind of makes it confusing. But those are the five secondary brain vesicles. So that this is still way before you're born, but there has been a lot more differentiation from just a simple neural tube by this point. Well, these five colors and these five secondary brain vesicles correspond to adult structures, or fully developed, as we see in slide C. So the colors match up here. Now notice from the bracketing, and this is why I started out saying that there's many different ways to say how the brain is divided. We can talk about the brain occurring as three major divisions: the forebrain, the midbrain, and the hindbrain. The reason these words are used is because they basically correspond to the three primary brain vesicles that start out in development. So the forebrain corresponds to prosencephalon, and that's actually what prosencephalon means, the front brain, or forebrain. Midbrain, self-explanatory, I already told you mesencephalon means that. And then the hindbrain corresponds to the rhombencephalon. But when you look at the detail in the bracketing, you can see the five, what corresponds to these five secondary vesicles. So the telencephalon, which gets its name because tele means far, right? I mean, it's at the tip. The telencephalon or telencephalon becomes, in the adult, the cerebrum. The diencephalon becomes the thalamus, the hypothalamus, the subthalamus, the epithalamus, and the pineal body. Okay, so that's all the blue region. The mesencephalon becomes, in the adult, the midbrain, which we can still call the mesencephalon. They mean the same thing. The metencephalon, which is one of the subdivisions of the rhombencephalon, become two things important in the brain, two major structures, the pons and the cerebellum, shown in one version of green here. And then finally, the fifth one, the myelencephalon, the other subdivision of the rhombencephalon, becomes the medulla oblongata. Okay, now let's go to five. Here we have a cutaway view that gives us a good view of what I was talking about in terms of meninges a little bit ago. The pia mater and the arachnoid mater are really just like they are in the spinal cord, only they're covering the brain instead. But what I said a little bit ago was that the dura mater, only around the brain, not around the spinal cord, is made up of two layers, labeled here, the periosteal layer and the meningeal layer. Now, the periosteal layer is named for the fact that this layer of the dura mater is the more superficial of the two, and therefore is right up against the bone, which is where the periosteum is, right? The periosteum covers the bone. Now, the periosteal layer of the dura mater is pressed right up against the bone, but it doesn't grow. It's not connected to the bone except at certain points in the skull. So it would be able to slip if you forced it to, whereas periosteum actually is growing right into the bone, right? It doesn't slip with respect to the bone itself. But the reason it's pressed up against that surface, the reason I say pressed, is because there's pressure from the cerebrospinal fluid that's deep to the dura. Now, the meningeal layer, of course, is named for the fact that it's closer to the brain where the rest of the meninges are. It's facing directly the arachnoid mater and indirectly the pia mater. So the two layers are in direct contact over most of the surface of the brain, the two layers of the dura. But there are places like the longitudinal fissure and another fissure that runs horizontally in the back where the two layers of the dura mater separate. And you're seeing that separation right here. Note, orient yourself on the skull here as to where this cut is made. So that this little triangular blue area there, that's the front of what we're looking at, as you see that it's being pulled up kind of like a little drawer from the skull. That is a place where the periosteal layer of the dura mater and the meningeal layer separate. And when they separate, they form spaces called sinuses. Now, sinus is another kind of general word that means a comparative enlargement. So certain veins get the name sinus because they get very large at a certain place. And paranasal sinuses are openings in the interior of certain skull bones right around the nose. That's what we usually mean when people say my sinuses are bad. That's the sinuses they're talking about. But sinuses is used to describe a lot of things. And notice this one is called the superior sagittal sinus because it runs along that longitudinal fissure that is sagittally placed, right? So remember that longitudinal fissure is a very deep crack that separates the two hemispheres. Well, the meningeal layer of the dura, well, let me start over. The periosteal layer of the dura just goes straight across from right to left. It's against the inside of the skull cap. But the meningeal layer, deep to that, will separate from that periosteal layer and run along the side of that hemisphere that's inside that longitudinal fissure. That's what we're seeing right here, where these two pieces of meningeal dura come together. So this is an example of what we call a dural fold. There are three major dural folds that separate major parts of the brain. But they're dural folds because they're folds in the dura mater. So this dural fold that you're looking at here that actually runs down into the longitudinal fissure is called the Fox cerebri. F-A-L-X is Fox. That's a word that means sickle because of how it's shaped, I guess. And cerebri referring to the cerebrum. C-E-R-E-B-R-I. Okay. Fox cerebri is one of the three major dural folds. The others aren't pictured here, but I'll describe them. You also have one called tentorium cerebelli, T-E-N-T-O-R-I-U-M, C-E-R-E-B-E-L-L-I. Not cerebri, but cerebelli. Okay? Tentorium is a word that means a roof-like covering, like a tent. The tentorium cerebelli is a dural fold that runs between the cerebellum and the cerebrum. All right? And then the third major dural fold is the Fox cerebelli. So almost the same as Fox cerebri, but cerebelli instead. But just like the Fox cerebri runs into the separation between the two cerebral hemispheres, the Fox cerebelli dips into the less deep crack between the two halves of the cerebellum, at the bottom part of the cerebellum. Now, notice that sticking into this superior sagittal sinus are two little structures, and there's more than two of them, there's just two shown here, that are outgrowths of the arachnoid mater, but that stick into the sinus, and notice that they are called arachnoid granulations. And those arachnoid granulations are drainage points for cerebrospinal fluid exiting the cerebrospinal fluid spaces so that it can be drained back into the bloodstream. I say back into the bloodstream because cerebrospinal fluid, when it's produced by the ependymal cells at the choroid plexuses that we've already talked about, it's produced by filtering blood. It's a filtrate of blood. It's not blood, but it comes from blood. That's what the ependymal cells at the choroid plexuses do. They filter blood to produce cerebrospinal fluid and then put it into the ventricles that they are part of. So that's continuously going on. Well, you can't just add cerebrospinal fluid continuously if you're not also draining it at the same rate somewhere else. That draining occurs at these arachnoid granulations. And so that the cerebrospinal fluid leaves the brain spaces at those places and puts it into the sinus itself, which is really just part of a big vein that's going to lead it back into the circulatory system, into the blood itself. So the cerebrospinal fluid does circulate, but it's not actively circulated by a pump the way the heart pumps the blood. Instead, it circulates because of movement of the cilia at the ependymal cells that produce the... Not all the ependymal cells are ciliated, but those that do help. Also, just head movements help bring up currents. And it circulates simply because it's being produced continuously at one end and it's being drained continuously at the other end. So cerebrospinal fluid is never very old. It's always fresh stuff because it's being turned over all the time. Let's go to 6 now and look at a closer detail of the ventricles. Not the vesicles, the ventricles. They're shown in this shaded teal color, and what you have to realize is that is deep in the brain, even though you're seeing it on the surface. This cerebrum surrounds these ventricles. They're not the ventricles are not at the surface. But you can see that the largest of the two by far are the two lateral ventricles, and you kind of get a view of on the left, the part A, that they are side by side, but you get a better view of that in B when you're looking at it from the front. So you can see that the lateral ventricles are not only much bigger than the other ventricles, but they're mirror images of each other, and that's why we don't call them first and second. They are the first and second, of course, but who's to say which is first? Notice that they're connected to each other, the two lateral ventricles, that is, are connected to each other by what are called interventricular foramina. There's an interventricular foramen on either side. And remember, foramen was a passageway in a bone. Here it's a passageway in the brain. So the interventricular foramen is also a space and is also therefore filled with cerebrospinal fluid. It's just not an enlarged space, which is why it's not a ventricle. So the two interventricular foramina come together to form the third ventricle. And that third ventricle is what I was saying is where you would find the string of the yo-yo. It's a space that occurs between the two lobed halves of the thalamus. Okay? And that's why in part A, the third ventricle, which is labeled there, notice the little brown spot in the middle of it. That's because that would represent the axle of the yo-yo. It's called the interthalamic adhesion because it adheres the two halves of the thalamus. But it's not space. It's neurons, and therefore the ventricle wraps around it. Okay, the third ventricle then, as I said before, gives rise to another space called the cerebral aqueduct, and therefore it contains cerebrospinal fluid as well. But then when it enlarges a little bit farther down, you have the fourth ventricle, and that's what I said occurs between the cerebellum and the pons. That's not the end of the line, though, because the fourth ventricle then narrows and becomes the central canal of the spinal cord. There's not nearly as much cerebrospinal fluid, especially in the adult spinal cord, as there is in the brain. But there is the opportunity for cerebrospinal fluid to go down that central canal, although there is none produced, no cerebrospinal fluid produced in the spinal cord. All of the choroid plexuses are in the brain. All right? Now, on part A, notice that there are a couple structures just under the fourth ventricle label there. A couple structures called the lateral and the median aperture. These lateral and median apertures, well, they're apertures, which are little openings. They are passageways for the cerebrospinal fluid to make it out of the core of the brain, which is where the ventricles are, and get into the subarachnoid space at the surface of the brain. So cerebrospinal fluid is not only found in these ventricles and passageways between them, part of its circulation is that it also bathes the exterior of the brain. Now, ventricles and cerebrospinal fluid are important for a few major reasons. One is that there's buoyancy because of the cerebrospinal fluid. The brain is fairly heavy, but if you have a fairly, but it's mostly, you know, it's about the density of water, the brain is. Well, that's much more dense than air. So if you have a brain sitting on a table out in the air, it's deforming itself because of its own weight. But if you have a brain in a vat of water, which is about the same density as the brain itself, it's fairly buoyant and therefore is supported by that liquid medium. Well, that's one of the functions of the cerebrospinal fluid. It takes a lot of the pressure off of the brain just because of its own weight, which would injure it otherwise. Another important thing is protection of the brain. And this is why it's important that it wraps around the outer surface and is also in the interior. If you didn't have these ventricles inside the depth of the brain, if it were just neural tissue all the way through, then movements of the head, getting hit on the head or something like that, would be a lot more injurious to the brain tissue. Having these inner ventricles act like little shock absorbers from within. But so does the cerebrospinal fluid that flows around the outside of the brain as well. And so when you get hit on the head, your skull moves, your brain doesn't, because of inertia. And without the cerebrospinal fluid on the other side, your brain would hit with great force against the inner part of that skull. By an analogy, if you consider taking an uncooked chicken egg and you put it into a cup, like a styrofoam cup, just the egg and the cup, that's it. You drop that, pretty good chance that egg is going to break. But if you put that same egg into the same cup, which you fill with water first, and drop it, pretty good chance it's not going to break when it hits the ground, because that water is going to act as a shock absorber. So that's what the cerebrospinal fluid does. The third major function is that cerebrospinal fluid maintains the chemical consistency of the brain medium. And that chemical consistency is different from what you would find in blood, for instance. Allows the brain to operate properly as long as it's not disturbed. The cerebrospinal fluid has to be homeostatically maintained. If there's an imbalance to the pH or some other aspect of the cerebrospinal fluid, the brain will be in trouble because of that. Well, let's look at the circulation of the cerebrospinal fluid in slide 7. The red areas next to the number 1 and 2 here are choroid plexuses. So you have choroid plexus in each of the two lateral ventricles. In all of the ventricles, you have a choroid plexus. And so remember, those are the only places where the cerebrospinal fluid is actually being produced, even though ependymal cells of the normal type are lining this entire surface that the cerebrospinal fluid is found at. So all these openings are lined by ependymal cells. Choroid plexus, though, is producing it as a filtrate of blood, like I said. So there are capillaries in these choroid plexuses providing the blood to the ependymal cells that then use, you know, filter that blood and make cerebrospinal fluid from it on the other side. And this is one place where we find a barrier. You've probably heard of the blood-brain barrier. Well, there is a barrier between the blood and the ependymal cells that make the at the choroid plexuses. The blood cerebrospinal fluid barrier, as it's called, because the blood carries a lot of things around to the body. Many of those things you do not want in the brain. You don't want them to contact the brain. So you don't want them. You don't want certain things to leak from the blood into the cerebrospinal fluid. You want to leave it entirely up to the ependymal cells as to what actually gets put into the cerebrospinal fluid. And so the ependymal cells at a choroid plexus are connected to each other by what are called tight junctions, intercellular junctions called tight junctions, that don't allow anything to slip into the space between the two cells. Therefore, the only way to get through that barrier that these cells are forming as a sheet is to go through the cells themselves. Okay, so it makes the ependymal cells the boss of what becomes cerebrospinal fluid, in a sense. You also, at the various places where there are blood vessels feeding the brain itself, have the other barrier, which is called the blood-brain barrier. And that's formed by similar tight junctions, not between ependymal cells, because those aren't there, but between the endothelial cells that make up the wall of the capillary. Now, do you remember what kind of neuroglia will signal the developing blood vessel cells to form these tight junctions and therefore seal off the blood from the brain? Yes. Astrocytes are important for that. And so, blood-brain barrier means that only certain things are able to pass from the blood that's getting sent close to the brain cells and the brain itself. Only things that are able to get through the cells. The rest of the body, capillaries are fairly leaky. Stuff is coming out of the bloodstream by squeezing in the spaces between the cells. This is how hormones get out of your bloodstream, for instance, which they need to do in order to have any effect on their target cells. The capillaries are leaky in most places in the body. They're not leaky at the brain. You have a blood-brain barrier. There are certain things that are able to get through the cells, though, like certain drugs, including alcohol. Alcohol can pass the blood-brain barrier. Certain other drugs do. Some don't. And the ones that don't, actually, that poses a problem if you're actually designing a drug to treat the brain. If it can't pass the blood-brain barrier, then it can't do its job. But anyway, those are the two major barriers. Let's go back to this circulation. So the cerebrospinal fluid is being produced by these choroid plexuses, first at the lateral ventricles, that in terms of the flow of information here, and that adds more cerebrospinal fluid at the lateral ventricles, of course, so that's the major driving force for the circulation. But as I said, these ependymal cells that make up the choroid plexuses are also ciliated, and so their whipping forms little currents as well. That cerebrospinal fluid then goes through the connection point to the third ventricle, where even more cerebrospinal fluid is added by the third ventricle's own choroid plexus, and then through the cerebral aqueduct when you get to the fourth ventricle, even more is added by that choroid plexus, and you can see that that's continuous with the central canal and the spinal cord. But importantly, all of this deep cerebrospinal fluid, which is where it's produced, leaks out through these lateral aperture and medium aperture that allows it to get to the space that surrounds the subarachnoid space that surrounds the brain itself. And once again, we see a view of these arachnoid granulations. They're not labeled that. They're labeled arachnoid villus. The arachnoid villus is the structure that is a finger-like projection of the arachnoid mater. That's what villus means. There are villi in all kinds of places in the body, including your small intestine. But anyway, an arachnoid villus includes within it an arachnoid granulation, and that arachnoid granulation is the set of cells that allows for this escape of cerebrospinal fluid into the sinus itself. So in the dark blue there, you have the sagittal sinus that collects all of this relatively old, it's not really all that old because it's continuously being made, but older cerebrospinal fluid, and that gets delivered into the general circulation, blood circulation. Now to 8. In 8, we're looking at the brainstem in a little bit closer detail, in isolated detail, so we can see it without the other structures around it for clarity. And the colors here correspond to the colors we've already used for the vesicles that we talked about, the embryonic vesicles. These are the colors in the adult structure, adult brain, of course. And like I said, this book chooses to include the diencephalon as part of the brainstem. But you can see that whether you can include it or not, the diencephalon is at the very tip, rostral tip of the brainstem. And here you can see the two blue halves of the thalamus. This is what I was saying is shaped kind of like a yo-yo. And that space between the two halves, that is the third ventricle. All right? So the diencephalon, as you see on the bottom detail here, includes thalamus. Also, it includes the pineal gland, which I mentioned before. And we're looking at a postural lateral view, so this is the back of it that we're looking at. The pineal gland, not only is part of the diencephalon, but you can see it from the rear view, and pineal means like a pine nut. It's about the size and the shape of a pine nut. Pineal gland, of course, is a gland. Anyone know what it secretes? It secretes melatonin. What is melatonin important for? Sleep-wake cycles, yes. So melatonin gets produced in the darkness. Production gets turned off in the light, and by it going up and down in level throughout the day, that's what partly regulates your circadian rhythms. And that's why third shifters, for instance, can have a disturbance in that because they're all artificial lighting in the middle of the night messes with that. Anyway, that's why it's called the pineal body. And not shown here, but also included in diencephalon, like I said, are the subthalamus, the epithalamus, and the hypothalamus as well. We'll have more to say about the hypothalamus in a different view. The mammillary bodies, which you don't see here because they're on the front, are shown on the top. Those are also part of the diencephalon, which is why they are in blue. Mammillary bodies get their, the mammillary body, I should say, gets its name because it's like a nipple in appearance. That's why it gets its name. All right, now, the front view, which we're looking at the top, also has a good view of these red, or I guess it's orange, parts of the midbrain itself. Notice it's labeled as the cerebral peduncle. You can see it here as well. Cerebral peduncle. Well, peduncle means little foot. Remember, foot is pes. Pedal means of the foot. The uncle part of that just means it's a diminutive suffix, so it just means a little. So it's a little foot, but the cerebral peduncle is a major passageway for information between the brainstem and the cerebrum. There are also cerebellar peduncles, but of course cerebellar peduncles are going to lead, they're not going to lead to the cerebrum, instead they're going to lead to the cerebellum. So I just mentioned those because I don't want you to confuse the terms. They're very similar. Cerebral here, cerebral peduncles. And that's one major part of the midbrain, the cerebral peduncles. The other major part, which you can see in this hind view, are four bulges in orange that are collectively called the corpora quadrigemina. Now, corpora is the plural of corpus. What does corpus mean? It means body. So corpora means bodies. Quadrigemina, what does that mean? Well, what does quadra mean? Four. Gemini, what does that mean? Twins. No zodiacal people here? I'm non-zodiacal myself, but people who care about such nonsense are might be just the Gemini sign. What is the symbol of Gemini? Twins. So corpora quadrigemina means four twin bodies because they're all about the same size and shape. But notice that they're arranged as two rows of two. There's four overall, but there's two in the top row, two in the bottom row. And therefore, they are, all four of them are collectively called the corpora quadrigemina, but the top row are called the superior colliculi. So that's the plural of colliculus. There's a left and a right version of the superior colliculus. And the ones in the bottom row are the inferior colliculi. Now, the superior colliculi are very important in processing visual information of different sorts. So, for instance, it's really the superior colliculi are important in getting your attention. When something moves and you move your head and you direct your eyes toward it, superior colliculi is largely responsible for that. And similarly, when you hear things and turn your head toward whatever the noise is, that's being processed by the inferior colliculi. Those are major parts of the midbrain. Then in green you have the pons. And here we can see, you don't see the whole thing, it's been cut here, but you can see cerebellar peduncles that I was talking about earlier. So the cerebral peduncle, part of the midbrain. Cerebellar peduncles, part of the pons. And just as I said, that's where the fourth ventricle is found as well. And then once you're into the dark green, I have to wrap it up here. Once you're into the dark green, you're in the medulla oblongata. In yellow, attached here and there, are several of the cranial nerves, which is the other focus of this chapter besides the brain, and which you're going to be responsible for knowing. There are 12 pairs of cranial nerves. Not all of them connect here at the brainstem, but many of them do. Notice that they are listed up there. We're going to revisit these, of course, but right now I got to stop.